We call House, or Senate has to order about 37 past the hour on the 13th. Our purpose today is to hear a presentation on pandemic influenza responses. We have present Senators Elton, Wilken, Olson, and myself, Dyson. Dr. Munsager.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. For the record, I'm Dr. Richard Munsager, Director of the Division of Public Health, and with me today is Dr. Jay Butler, our new state epidemiologist and chief of the Section of Epidemiology. So this will be your opportunity to meet Jay over the next hour, hour and a half.
What have you been doing, Doctor?
Prior to coming to the state, I've been director of the CDC's Arctic Investigations Program in Anchorage.
Wow. How long were you been in Alaska?
Since 1998.
Good. Thank you for helping us.
Glad to be here.
So, with the permission of the chair and the members, our goal for the next minutes to a couple hours, if it takes that long, is to present a summary of the discussion of avian influenza, what is it, and then pandemic influenza, what are the chances, what's the preparation, what's the journey, what's the work ahead of us. You have in your packets four things, and I just want to tell you what's there as we get started. First is a brochure that's been recently developed as of about a month ago, being used as a handout in communities, hunter groups, public, and so on. And as time goes by, this will be updated, and so hopefully this is a print media piece of information of use to the public. Second is an administrative order signed by the governor, 228, signed a month ago on January 9th, and we'll be talking about this during the part of the presentation dealing with preparedness. And this is an order to the administrative part of state government about the interagency preparation work requirements, and I'll tell you a little bit when we get to that part of the presentation as to where we are and what's ahead of us across the various state agencies. The third document that's called State of Alaska Pandemic Influenza Preparedness Concept Plan, a bunch of words, is the background for what the implementing the administrative order entails, the kind of tasks that are in front of us, and the objectives over the next few months across state government and as we engage more in businesses and other community leaders outside of state government in our preparedness journey. And I'll refer to that too as we go along. So as I said, Jay recently joined us back in November. He's been with the Centers for Disease Control for his career. He's one of these doctors that has all kinds of degrees behind his name. He's a pediatrician, he's an internist, he is an infectious disease expert, and he's been a researcher. He's been with CDC his whole career. In my view, in my first year in this job, one of the most important things I did was to help us find a new epidemiologist for the state, and recruiting Jay and getting the Centers for Disease Control to allow him to come to work for us. It was a happy day when we heard it was going to happen. There were a lot of not so sure moments in that journey. And so the two of us plan to share this presentation. And Jay's going to do the first part about influenza, the science, and then I'm going to talk about the preparation part at the end. And we invite questions. It's right after lunch. People could get sleepy if we don't invite questions. So we hope you will interrupt, ask questions as we go.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Munsager. And indeed, it does run the risk of being a biology lesson, so let's make this interactive with your permission, Senator, and feel free to interrupt and ask questions as we go. Let me start with just answering the question, what is influenza? We talk about the flu quite a bit, but oftentimes what we call the flu is not influenza. For the purpose of this conversation, influenza is primarily a respiratory tract infection caused by a specific group of viruses known as the influenza viruses. It's spread by respiratory droplets, which you can see quite well in this slide here, which just means that as we cough and sneeze, droplets come out of our mouths. Perhaps if I'm infectious, Dr. Munsager will get ill, but everybody else in the panel here will be out of my range. Illness for influenza usually begins after a 1 to 5 day incubation period. So if I were exposing Dr. Monsager today, he would probably become ill sometime between tomorrow and end of the week. People who are infected with influenza are infectious from the day before or the day of illness onset and are infectious generally for 3 to 5 days. Children may be infectious for a little longer period of time. There are three major types of influenza viruses. Influenza A is mostly what we're going to talk about today. This is what types of influenza A are what cause annual winter epidemics. This is also what causes pandemics, which is the focus of our discussion today. There are two other types of influenza viruses, influenza B, which also occasionally causes winter epidemics, and then influenza C is thought to be fairly uncommon, occasionally causes upper respiratory tract infections. It's not thought to be a particularly medically important virus. If nothing else, you probably know more about influenza than your physicians do at this point, that you know that influenza C exists, with all due respect to your physicians. Now, influenza A comes in a number of different types, and the typing is based on the surface projections from the virus, which I'm going to just call those surface projections H and N. There are 16 H types, 9 N types, and that's where we get these subtyping names that seem rather unimaginative, like H5N1. It's based on those surface components of the virus. Influenza A exists in nature primarily in aquatic birds. This is the reservoir of the virus in nature, infecting birds, geese, and swans, also shorebirds. Occasionally, certain strains will jump species, and there are strains of influenza that are specific for horses. Many of the strains are capable of infecting pigs. Here in Alaska, we're always interested in things like seals and whales, and indeed there are strains of influenza that have adapted to infect seals and whales. They're not of importance to humans. Economically important.
Go ahead and finish your presentation. I just had a question on the H and N types. You're talking about the antigens in them.
Yes.
On the outside of the cell that they infect?
Through the chair, these are actually projections on the surface of the virus itself, and the H is
the RNA.
Well, the RNA is the genetic component that's within the virus itself. The H and the N are surface components. I picture it sort of like an orange. At Christmas time at my house, we have oranges. We put cloves into them. Within that orange is the 8 strands of RNA, which are the genes of the virus. On the outside are the H and the Ns, which come in all these different types. And they serve a purpose for causing disease. The H, which stands for hemagglutinin, is actually what binds to the respiratory tract of humans or whatever animal is infected. The N, which stands for neuraminidase, is the component of the virus that helps it break out of infected cells.
And so what does the enzyme neuraminidase have to do with
it? When cells become infected and the virus gets inside, it reproduces to high numbers, and the neuraminidase is what allows the virus to get out of the cell, basically burst out in large numbers of viruses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of economic importance is the fact that several of the avian strains are capable of infecting domestic poultry. We're going to focus primarily on human influenza, or at least that's what we day-to-day focus on. These are influenza A subtypes that spread widely among humans and can be spread person to person. Currently, there are 3 types causing disease among humans, H1N1, H3N2, and H1N2. The H1N1 is the descendant of the strain that caused the 1918 pandemic of influenza. The H3N2, which is the most common one right now, is the descendant of the 1968 pandemic. There were 3 pandemics during the 20th century. We think as many as 10 pandemics in the past 300 years. A pandemic occurs whenever a new strain occurs which is capable of infecting humans to which we have no immunity. Avian influenza is a term that's applied to influenza A that's found mainly in birds, and there's 2 types. Low pathogenic is most common, and the disease may be mild or absent. In commercial flocks, it's manifest most often primarily as ruffled feathers, reduced egg production.
However, some of these strains can become highly pathogenic, and that's defined as strains that are capable of killing more than 75% of experimentally infected chickens. And in agricultural situations, the high pathogenic strains can kill up to 100% of the birds that are infected, so clearly an economically important infection.
From the standpoint of the reproduction system, is that virus able to go ahead and penetrate the egg as well?
It's not so much, unlike the situation with salmonella, it's not so much a matter of it penetrating the egg as the outside of the egg can become infected through the chair. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of transmission via eggs. The shell of the egg can become contaminated, yes.
That's for the time that we're on this. We can dispense with most of the formalities, and you can recognize anybody that's asking the question and cut me out of the loop. Unless it gets too wild.
So as soon as the egg is broken, the exposure to the chick then is automatic?
Well, it would occur through exposure to the other infected birds in the flock.
I see.
Now, H5N1 avian influenza is one that certainly attracted a lot of attention recently. This was first isolated from terns in South Africa in 1961, but that was a low pathogen strain. H5N1 actually circulates globally in wild birds.
Did you say what low path means?
Yes. These are the types of avian influenza that cause very mild or no disease at all in birds. High path are the ones that can cause high mortality, particularly in commercial flocks. H5N1 has actually been isolated from wild birds in North America in the past, but that has always been the low path strains. In 1997, a highly pathogenic strain of H5N1 emerged among domestic poultry in Hong Kong. It was unusual in a couple of ways. Most importantly was the fact that it caused severe disease among humans that were infected. Prior to 1997, only H7 strains of avian influenza had infected human, and it primarily caused very mild disease, conjunctivitis. These people, when they became ill, developed severe respiratory symptoms, and 18 people were infected. Of those, 6 had died, and no one had ever died of avian influenza prior to this time. The virus was contained in 1997 primarily through control of the infected poultry flocks, but reemerged in Vietnam in December of 2003. Now, transmission of H5N1 avian influenza to humans has primarily been through direct contact with infected domestic poultry or their secretions. Human-to-human spread has been very rare to date. There's been one small cluster in a family in Thailand in September of 2004 where a child became infected, appears to have spread the infection to her mother, who had no exposure to poultry. That's the most well-documented instance, but further transmission did not occur. During 2005, the virus spread throughout Eurasia. This slide shows countries in orange that had human cases of infection, and in yellow, countries where the infection was detected among birds. And this is specifically for the Asian strain of H5N1, the same one that has caused infections in humans. Now, this slide's already terribly out of date. Just in the first weeks of 2006, a lot of new developments have occurred. After the first infections among birds were identified in Turkey in October of this past year, a cluster of infections among humans occurred during January, with 21 cases under investigation now, 4 of which have been fatal. All of those infections occurred after exposure to infected domestic poultry. Infected birds have also been identified recently in Greece, in Italy, and in Bulgaria. And perhaps most concerning is the discovery of H5N1 avian strains infecting domestic poultry in Nigeria.
Is that a yellow dot at London under UK?
That's a small dot that was added by the WHO. It's actually reflecting an imported bird that was intercepted there, but it did not spread infection into UK. Oh, yes, and Dr. Monsager reminded me, of course, during the past couple of weeks, infection has been identified in Iraq and the first human case has also been identified in Iraq. So we currently have 7 countries where there have been cases of human infection with H5N1.
And that was an Iraqi?
Yes, 15-year-old girl.
One of the soldiers from
Iraq. No, it was an Iraqi citizen.
They're reporting today a case on the border of Denmark.
Is that a, I believe that's a, in birds, correct?
About birds, yes.
Yeah. So why should we care? This slide shows the recipe for an influenza pandemic. The first ingredient is a new influenza virus to which the population has little immunity, and we actually have that in the form of H5N1. The second ingredient is the ability of the virus to replicate in humans and to cause disease. We just made this slide last Thursday. It's already a little out of date. There were 2 additional fatal cases identified in Indonesia over the weekend and 1 additional fatal case in China, giving a total of 169 cases and 91 deaths in Eurasia since December of 2003. The third and perhaps most critical ingredient is efficient and sustained person-to-person transmission, which fortunately has not yet occurred with H5N1. Now, the reason this is important is when we look at the pandemics of the 20th century and apply that to the Alaska population today, we get numbers like this. In pandemics, the population is highly susceptible, and over a period of about 12 to 18 months, we would anticipate about a third of the population to become ill, which for Alaska translates into a number of roughly 200,000. We'd anticipate about half of those people to be ill enough to seek medical care, resulting in about 100,000 people seeking care in the clinics. Now, the estimates for hospitalizations become very wide-ranging based on the differences in the ability of various pandemic strains to cause disease. The lower limits here are based on the type of viruses that caused pandemics in 1957 and 1968. The higher estimates are based on the 1918 strain, which, as you're probably aware, is one of the more severe pandemics that's really been documented as being due to influenza. Given this range, we would estimate that the next pandemic will result in anywhere from 2,000 to 22,000 hospitalizations. To put that number into perspective, there are 1,400 licensed hospital beds in Alaska. We would anticipate that some proportion, roughly a tenth of these people, may actually require care in the intensive care unit, and some of those would require mechanical ventilation.
Excuse me.
Yes.
How do you treat the patient?
The treatment of severe influenza, if it can be started early, includes antiviral drugs. Beyond that, it's primarily supportive and treatment of secondary infections that occur. Many of the influenza deaths during the 1957 and 1968 pandemics were actually due to bacterial pneumonia, which occurred as a complication of influenza. The 1918 pandemic behaved a little differently in that there were many more people who died very quickly of their primary influenza infection.
And the assault they have on the respiratory system, is that permanent or temporary? I mean, are the people on ventilation going to have to stay on ventilation?
Most of the people who go on ventilators, once they come off, are able to return to relatively full recovery. The long-term effects of influenza are a topic of ongoing debate in medical circles. There's some concern about whether or not some of the cases of Parkinson's disease, for instance, that we saw during the middle of the 20th century was related to the 1918 pandemic strain. I think the bottom line is, apart from some of those discussions, most people, if they can survive their infection, do very well.
How long do you anticipate people on being on the respirator?
Well, it depends on how severely ill they are. Ideally, people are going on the ventilator only for a few days, but unfortunately what oftentimes does happen during severe illness is other organs begin to fail. And ultimately, that's the most powerful predictor in terms of who comes out of the intensive care unit to another hospital bed or goes to the morgue, is how many organs they have failing.
And so as you look at some of the deaths that were there before, did they actually go to some form of ICU with ventilation capability?
Well, the 1968 pandemic is probably the one where we can say that there was the closest to modern intensive care support. That was fairly early in the days of using mechanical ventilation.
My question wasn't for that. Was
oh, I'm sorry.
This, for the 91 people that have died so far, 170 cases, did they have ICU capabilities where they were at?
It varies in the different countries. Many of the cases that have been diagnosed have been people who were able to enter into the medical system and get intensive care support. So there may be other cases out there that we're not aware of. But certainly a number of the 91 people who have died have had, as we say, the full court press, being admitted to an intensive care unit and getting mechanical ventilation and as much support as you would get in a hospital in Alaska. That's not true across the board, but in general, that has happened frequently.
Do we have any evidence that any set of human conditions make you more vulnerable for getting the influenza?
Well, with respect to seasonal influenza, certainly the extremes of age tend to make the illness more severe. The older you get, the more likely you are to actually die of influenza. There's a higher rate of deaths among children, although there's also a very, very high rate of infection among children. So proportionally, it may be lower among young children, meaning in the first 2 years of life. But if we wanted to graph out the risk of death or the rate of death in the population, the highest would be in the very young and the very old. Persons with underlying heart or lung disease or at increased risk of dying, people with immune compromise for various reasons may be at increased risk of dying. For the next pandemic, it's a little harder to say. Certainly the 57 and 68 pandemics tended to behave like seasonal influenza. The worst mortality was among the elderly. The 1918 pandemic was different in that it was the people aged 25 to 40 years of age that suffered the highest death rate. Part of that may be just differences in the virus. That virus appears to have been able to induce an immune response which was actually damaging to particularly the lungs, a term called cytokine storm, which you may be familiar with. The H5N1 virus, when it infects people, appears to cause a fairly similar type of reaction as well. So it can be, that's part of the reason why you see a tenfold increase or a tenfold difference in some of these numbers here is, you know, we don't know what the next pandemic strain is going to be, so these are really our best guesses, not uneducated guesses, but to be honest, they're estimates which can be termed guesses.
And did you say that the means of transmission is always through breathing in the pathogens?
Well, its respiratory droplets means that it can travel through the air short distances, but it's different from, say, an airborne disease like tuberculosis or measles, where if I were coughing, I might infect the air in the entire building. The influenza viruses are fairly stable in the environment, so we think equally important to my being close to Dr. Monsager and perhaps sharing saliva with him as I cough and sneeze would be actually touching the transmission on the hands.
So ordinary hygiene kinds of things are really helpful.
Absolutely. When we consider deaths, we would estimate there would be anywhere from 400 to 4,000 deaths in Alaska during the next pandemic. Let me put these numbers into a little bit of a perspective for you. We think somewhere between 50 and 100 people die of influenza during just a regular influenza season. So 400 is a considerable increase. 4,000 is quite high. Last year in Alaska, for all causes, roughly 3,000 people died. So this would be more than a doubling of our overall mortality rate. I'm sure you've heard some of the anecdotal reports of the 1918 pandemic in western Alaska. In some villages, the mortality rate was actually over 50%. which is a phenomenon I cannot explain to you, but certainly one that's well documented. When we think about what we can do about these numbers, there's three tools in the public health toolbox that are available to us or that we turn to initially. The first is vaccines, which we will not have on day one of the next pandemic. As you're probably aware, there is a vaccine against H5N1 strain that's under development, but we don't know that H5N1 is going to be the next pandemic strain. So I think the take-home message there is that when the next pandemic comes, we probably won't have a vaccine for immediate use. Second is antiviral drugs, which need to be used early on. The national plan for pandemic planning includes an emphasis on antiviral drugs for treatment of people at highest risk of death and calls for stockpiling of some 80 million courses of antiviral drugs. The bad news is about a third of that responsibility for about a third of that falls to the state, which would translate for Alaska into a stockpiling of about 20,000 doses or courses of antiviral drugs. The third tool is infection control measures, which would be both personal protective supplies as well as education to be for people to be able to reduce the risk of transmission in healthcare facilities and in communities. And that reminds me that hand hygiene, as you already mentioned, is an important part of that. It's incredibly easy, and it's part of our health education, and it can even be done while talking with Senate subcommittees. So, as I wrap up my portion, I wanted to address three common misperceptions about pandemic influenza. Do you need any? I got a little extra here. The first is that an influenza pandemic is overdue and that it'll be caused by the H5N1 strain. This is really a gambler's fallacy. There's no biologic clock ticking. Just because the ball of the roulette wheel hasn't fallen on zero for the past 10 spins, it doesn't mean that it's any more likely to in the 11th spin. Because we've not had a pandemic since 1968 means that we're no more likely to in 2006 or 2007 than we have before. We also don't know what type of influenza will cause the next pandemic. We are very much focused on H5N1 right now, but it's important to keep in mind that there are other strains that can cause a pandemic. That said, what's different today than in the past is that we have better technology to recognize the trends in viral evolution over even a period of months, and what's happening with influenza infection in animals and in humans. So our radar is much better to see what the incoming viruses are, if you will. We can't really ignore that any more than we can ignore the satellite images and not make decisions about hurricane planning until a landfall occurs. We have the ability to see much more into the viral world and see what types of viruses may be causing problems in the near future.
Doctor, yes. When a bird has or is carrying, what are the symptoms they show?
The highly pathogenic strains can be carried by migratory birds. The high path is predicated primarily on the pathogenicity or the ability to cause disease in domestic poultry. And that's one of the ways that the virus may be spreading around the world is through migratory fowl. It may also be spreading through the poultry trade, some of that legal, some of that illegal. Not only domestic poultry, which are bought and sold for food purposes, but also through the exotic pet trade. There have been instances where birds smuggled into Europe for the pet trade have been tested and found to be infected with H5N1.
My question was, what are the symptoms that the bird shows?
In many wildfowl, there may be very few symptoms. In certain species of birds, there may be large die-offs.
Okay, so with mad cow disease, finally the cow starts showing symptoms, but there's nothing that the general population could be alerted or to watch for in our migratory birds, for instance, except the large die-off?
Well, large die-off may be a way to recognize when when a highly pathogenic strain enters into an area. But it's important to remember that's a fairly poor signal because there are certain species which become infected and do not die off. That's part of how the spread can occur through migratory birds because dead birds don't migrate. But certain species, particularly the ones that serve as the reservoir for influenza A, like ducks, geese, and swans, although they do occasionally become ill, they are much more capable of carrying the virus asymptomatically and infecting other birds where they migrate to. I'm hoping I addressed your question.
So if, how would a person who contacted avian flu, how would we begin to suspect that they had anything different than ordinary flu?
The cardinal ways that we would recognize a problem and specifically test for, for the sake of the discussion, particularly the H5N1 strain, would be someone who has recently traveled to an area where we know that there is H5N1. If we had an Alaskan that had no travel, but we knew there was exposure to sick poultry, that might be the other situation where we would want to specifically test. Each one of these we would address on a case-by-case basis.
So then are you getting the message out statewide for anybody that's a practitioner that's seeing flu-like symptoms in a patient to start asking these questions?
Yeah, we've used our epidemiology bulletin as a way to alert clinicians in Alaska about H5N1, the particular concerns in Alaska, and also the availability of diagnostic testing within state now. Also have just been going out and doing the medical round circuits and speaking with physicians at their various grand rounds to make sure that people are aware of the clinical manifestations of H5N1 as well as the availability of tests.
And so what are those clinical manifestations?
The H5N1 in humans, and keep it in context of we've only had, I say only, but there have been less than 200 cases to date, but it appears if we wanted to have a classic description, it's a fairly severe respiratory illness which rapidly progresses to pneumonia, a syndrome known as the adult respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, and sometimes multi-organ failure as well. Fever is a very common manifestation. If we had to say how is it different from just a really bad case of seasonal influenza, the patients with H5N1 don't seem to have quite as much of the muscle ache as you or I have probably had whenever we've had seasonal influenza, and they may actually be more likely to have some of the gastrointestinal symptoms, particularly diarrhea.
Senator Olson had a question.
No, actually I didn't.
Senator Elton.
Doctor, a couple of basic questions for you. The doctor is at the other end of the line here, but if in fact it's in poultry, does cooking get rid of the viral condition? Do you need to worry about it? If you cook your chicken.
Yep. The virus is inactivated at temperatures 155 to 165 degrees, and we specifically addressed that in some initial guidelines we put out for hunters in Alaska, recommending that that wild game, even though we don't have documentation that the infection can be spread through eating infected birds, and we don't yet have evidence that the Asian H5N1 strain is in Alaska, we recommend that any game that is going to be eaten, any poultry, should be cooked to an internal temperature of at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit.
And then a second question. Doctor, I want to make sure that I heard correctly. It seems to me that the problem with the pandemic is that it might not be this virus. It could be something else. And you don't. If you don't know what it is, you can't develop a vaccine. So we're kind of. All you can do right now is observe, right? And all the medical community can do is keep track of reports on where the contact may have come from poultry, and then determine whether or not it's gone from human to human.
There's more we can do. let me just start just with the issue of vaccines. Part of the challenge with vaccines for the next pandemic is twofold. One is what we don't know. And that's what exactly the next strain will be. The best vaccine will be based on that pandemic strain. The second is how we do it. And that's where we actually have an opportunity, when I say we, the medical community as a whole, to make some progress. Currently, influenza vaccines are mass-produced using the same technology we were using 50 years ago, which basically involves inoculating a large number of fertilized eggs and then harvesting the virus, inactivating it, creating the vaccine. That process takes about 6 to 9 months. Part of the federal funding that has gone out through HHS is focusing on developing new technologies based on cell culture to move that process along and hopefully shorten it to a period of just a few months. That's a promise that's on the horizon and has not yet arrived, though. So certainly if we have a pandemic anytime, I think, in the next couple of years, we will not have a vaccine probably for about the first 6 months or so.
Okay.
A second common misperception about pandemic influenza is that, like a forest fire, an influenza pandemic can be snuffed out if caught early. Now, the outbreaks of avian influenza among poultry, this is probably true, that the birds can be quarantined, that infected flocks can be culled, and that the infection can be controlled for at least a period of time. Once the virus is able to spread person to person, this is very unlikely. Given that it has a short incubation period, and as I mentioned earlier, that viral shedding can occur very early after infection, this is probably pretty unlikely. Now, what we can do probably is slow the spread of infection and allow more time for a vaccine to be available, allow time for distribution of antiviral drugs. And I wanted to suggest to this group that maybe the forest fire is the wrong analogy to use, that perhaps the way we should think of influenza pandemics is more like how we think of Augustine volcano or the risk of earthquake in Alaska. These are things that will happen, and we can't prevent them, but what we can do is mitigate the consequences. The final misperception is that there's nothing we can do, and the federal government's going to take care of all of this anyway. Everybody smiles when I say that. Preparedness is critical for mitigation, but as we've already discussed, vaccines will probably not be available at the beginning of the next pandemic. Antiviral drugs may be in short supply. As we already mentioned, that the burden of purchasing antiviral drugs is not completely going to be borne by the federal government. But there are things that we can all do, both personally and as government. And with that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Dr. Monsager.
Before we go on, can you just tell me more about some of the antiviral drugs? We're all familiar with acyclovir and something like that, which is obviously not a virus that we're talking about here. What's the availability and what are the costs of these new antiviral drugs, and are they affordable?
Yeah.
To the general public, or do they need to be dispersed because they are so expensive?
Yeah, there are four antiviral drugs specific for influenza, which are in two major classes. The older class, known as the M2 inhibitors, are amantadine and rimantadine. We have a number of years of experience with those agents now. Unfortunately, these are the drugs that seasonal influenza have become increasingly resistant to, and particularly this year, it appears that the majority of influenza isolates are resistant to these two drugs. The newer class of antiviral drugs for influenza are the neuraminidase inhibitors, and it's the same N neuraminidase that the N comes from in the name of the various strains. Oseltamivir is probably the one you've heard the most about. Tamiflu is the brand name. It comes in a tablet form. There's also one known as zanamivir, which comes as a powder, which has to be inhaled. These drugs can reduce the severity of influenza if they're started in the first 48 hours after infection. They also may play a role in preventing infection if started before exposure occurs. The cost of oseltamivir is one of the things that is a challenge. I don't know what the public sector cost will be, but in the private sector, oseltamivir runs about $40 for a course of medication.
And the course is how long?
The course is for 5 days. For a treatment course, it's twice a day for 5 days.
Giving you protection for how long?
For protection, it really depends on what the goal is. If it's after exposure, or if we had a vaccine and could then tide someone over until the vaccine had time to take effect, it would be for about 10 days, one dose a day for 10 days. In the instance where we had no vaccine, that's a much more complicated discussion, is how to manage the limited supplies of oseltamivir we have, whether it really makes sense to use it for a prolonged period as a prophylactic treatment. And I think there may be a role for that in very selected instances, but probably fairly limited. The other challenge, of course, is the supply of oseltamivir. In the state, there's at best 1,000 courses available right now. In the country, about 5 million in the federal stockpile.
So, is the mad cow disease a pandemic or an epidemic?
No, it's really neither. Pandemic is a term that is sometimes used for any epidemic that occurs worldwide, and I think that's an appropriate use of the word. In the instance of influenza, it's particularly used for a new strain which the human population is not immune to, so that it can spread rapidly around the world because it is a fairly easily transmitted disease. Mad cow disease is thought to be foodborne through ingestion of primarily infected beef. The vast majority of cases have occurred in Great Britain. To date, there have been no Americans who have come down with mad cow disease, although there have been British expatriates who've been diagnosed in the United States. Worldwide, I think there's still only about 180 cases total of mad cow disease over the past roughly 15 years.
So by its size, it's neither?
Yes.
It's a function of magnitude?
Yeah. Pandemic and epidemic are the type of terms that epidemiologists can debate about for hours on end and frequently are used in the media. They can be very emotionally charged. So I sometimes tend to avoid using them. In the case of influenza, pandemic is a very well-defined term and a very appropriate term.
Alaskan that died of mad, that died of the prion anyway, was Fairbanks. Is that true?
I'm not aware of that.
How did that make it true? I think the lady from Fairbanks died.
Oh, yeah. Now, horse bug Yakov disease is a different type of disease. Occurs sporadically, also within families. It's different from the variant mad cow disease, or variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is also called mad cow disease. Classic Creutzfeldt-Jakob is not known to be foodborne. It's one of those diseases that happens and is mediated by prions, which of course are somewhat mysterious microbes to begin with, in that they have no genetic material. They are basically proteins that are able to change how the body produces proteins. They're the kind of thing that if we'd imagined microorganisms without genetic material in medical school, we probably would have flunked microbiology.
So with that, kind of the science background, then the question is, what do we do? Do we let this happen, or are there ways we can mitigate and diminish the effect of this on our communities? And that's what I want to talk about for the next few minutes, is what can we do, what's reasonable to do, what in the public policy arena should we be thinking about doing? And public health has a role, and that's why we're here today. And the roles we have working with communities and individuals are on this slide. When we use the phrase plan, train, and exercise, it's around questions about, if we are going to give limited medicines and we have some in stockpiles, who are we going to give them to? How do we get them out quickly enough, given what Dr. Butler said about how quickly you have to get them out there? If we have enough that we're going to give them for prophylaxis, who we're going to give them to? When we do get vaccines, how are we going to vaccinate people quickly? How are we going to work with communities around alternate care sites? He's already talked about the fact we won't have enough hospital beds. So where are we going to put sick people if the family members can't take care of their family member? What are we going to do with special needs populations where people don't have the ability to take care of themselves? How are communities going to take care of those folks? And how do we engage people to say this is important enough to put on their busy agenda to think about planning? And that's really why Jay and I are on the speaking circuit right now, I would say, is try to engage community and business leaders to think about this, and they're already busy, and to think about what are they going to do if and when this happens to mitigate the effects on their business and on the communities. So it's not like we're starting from zero. Last year, the public health law that was debated was put into place, and I talked last year about the fact that if we have problems and need quarantine and isolation authorities, how would we use it? We didn't have authority. What would we do? So we have a law. Parenthetically, the regulations implementing that are out for public comment right now and closed soon. We've been doing a lot of work around emergency planning with communities. Last August, you may remember the big Arctic Shield Northern Edge exercise that the military and communities did in many parts of Alaska. We were a part of that. And testing our, basically, the incident command structure, the national response plan mandates that all of us use the same management information methods and tools in an emergency. And so we have now tested in that exercise, and we have done multiple tabletop exercises about what would we do in communities A, B, or C. Mass prophylaxis, we're using the annual seasonal flu vaccine in the fall time to go to enlist communities. Fairbanks was one of the communities this year in which we tested to see how many people per hour we could process for vaccines. Valdez, we did also this year. Valdez showed that they actually immunized over 40% of the community and had enough capacity. They could have vaccinated 100% of the community in one day. In Fairbanks, they learned, and this is our goal, is that they can a community could process over 500 people an hour if we're going to try and do mass vaccination clinics.
What's the form of vaccine are you actually?
We're testing these clinics using the annual fall flu vaccine. So the last 2 years we've talked to communities to engage communities that want to test this, test their own planning, and to improve their own readiness. Where are they going to find volunteers from? Where would be the location they would do it? Do they have enough stuff to process it? What are the logistics problems? And probably the biggest exercise we've done so far has been in Fairbanks. Last August, during the Arctic Shield Northern Edge, Anchorage tested the ability to give out medicines. They gave out Skittles, I think it was, or M&Ms as a surrogate for pills to test how many pills and could they check for allergies and so on and process people fast. I want to talk some about bird disease surveillance because this is going to be a hot topic this year. For the United States, Alaska is the epicenter of bird surveillance for this summer 2006. Why? It has everything to do with migratory birds and the protection of the domestic poultry industry. In our case, in Alaska, we're concerned about the human protection for folks that are hunters in our state, too, that handle game birds and so on. USDA has money, U.S. Fish and Wildlife has money, U.S. Geologic Survey have money appropriated by the Congress for surveillance. And because the nesting area for many Eurasian species is Alaska, and they mix with birds that come up the Pacific and Midwest flyways and California flyways, the concern is if this H5N1 gets to Alaska, then it is very likely to mix with birds heading down to the lower 48. And protection of the domestic poultry industry is of critical importance. Now, about 6 weeks ago, I and the other state health officers across the country were asked to participate in a conference call, and it was led by the Assistant Secretary for Health and a physician who's an Assistant Secretary at U.S. Department of Agriculture. They didn't tell us what the intent was. They only wanted all of us to participate. Well, it started out appearing to be avian flu 101, and all stuff that we were familiar with, and I kept waiting for the intent. Finally, about 75% of the way through the hour, it became clear what the goal was when the public information officer got on the phone and said, we want you to be really careful in the language you use with the public, because the chicken industry is petrified that the market's going to go south. Already in places like Turkey, and when this got to Turkey in January, in the Christmas time, the domestic chicken industry basically vaporized just overnight from people's concerns about the question that Senator Elton asked, which is chicken safe to eat? And the domestic poultry industry in the United States is a $20 billion industry. And Tyson stock, frankly, has dropped 20% over the last 6 weeks as this rapid spread worldwide has really accelerated. So it was really interesting to me about the language that we use about appropriate care and preparation and not feeding into unreasonable paranoia is a real careful balancing act that the two of us have to be careful about as we talk to the public.
So next Thanksgiving, we're all going to be eating ham? Or
Well, it's an interesting question. We don't have much for domestic poultry industry in Alaska. There are a lot of people that do have backyard flocks. Mm-hmm. Near Palmer, there's an organic turkey business, and they really advertise in the Anchorage market that they have range-grown turkeys. Well, range-grown, if and when H5 gets here, is a big concern to the poultry industry, because that seems to be where the mixing occurs between wild birds and poultry. And so the advice to the commercial poultry industry in the United States is keep all your birds inside and make sure that your staff don't go spreading disease from or walking from farm to farm. How do you do that with backyard poultry industry? So just to get to the question in just a second. So this summer, those federal agencies are funding a big bird surveillance effort across Alaska. They're targeting the species that are known to come up the Eurasia Flyway to Alaska, the species that come from Southeast Asia and China and nest in Alaska. They're targeting the places those birds nest. They'll also be partnering with native organizations for the spring egg and subsistence hunting industry, so they'll swab and test dead birds. Right now the plan is that all those samples are going to be sent to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Lab in Madison, Wisconsin. We have been talking as a group of federal or state agencies and advocating that Alaska needs to have screening capacity for bird samples. Last summer there was a lot of surveillance of bird samples too, and we still don't have reports on the majority of those samples from last summer. The new laboratory that DEC has in Anchorage is ready and able to screen bird samples if it has capacity and capability, and we've been talking with Senator Stevens' office about trying to make sure some of that federal money gets directed to rapidly building capacity in Anchorage so at least some or a majority of the samples could be screened in Alaska. As Dr. Butler said, we have capacity at the Fairbanks Human Virology Laboratory now to screen a small number of human samples, and because the numbers will be small, each of them will be handled on a one-by-one authorization process between doctors and Dr. Butler's staff for the immediate future. But you're going to hear a lot about bird surveillance in Alaska this summer, because there'll be a lot of birds surveyed. The federal agencies and the state agencies are collaborating. The Migratory Bird Council is involved in terms of the sites and locations and species that they'll be watching and culturing.
So, to repeat my earlier question, what will they look for except dead birds?
What they'll do is they will swab the cloacas and collect basically feces samples, because a lot of these wild birds carry this virus without getting sick. It was thought initially, I'd say not as recently as a year ago, that probably birds couldn't go across the ocean. At least there were a lot of folks arguing that. Some people were arguing that it was only a matter of time until it started spreading by migratory birds, and I think the majority opinion today is it's spreading by migratory birds, and we need to be watching for when or if it sets itself in North America. So they'll be looking both for die-off, but they'll also be swabbing apparently healthy birds.
Okay.
End of October, early November, there was a fascinating story in USA Today about Foster Farms. Did you see it? And it was the story about what Foster Farms has done to isolate their chickens, and the protections taken for people coming on campus and off campus.
And the clean feet, the, you couldn't go from one building to another without going through clean rooms. I mean, it was really fascinating about what they were doing, and the fact that they were doing it was interesting. And then the next piece of that, which is the free market, is that, of course, they want to roll that thought of people that they're, you know, we used to have contented cows, now we have protected chickens. Yeah. So they wanted to roll that into their marketing so they can say, we at Foster Farms are virus-free. But it was just amazing what they were doing in a clean room environment to keep those chickens well kept.
There was another similar article about chicken commercial industry in the central Joaquin Valley in California, where there's a lot of commercial chickens too, and how the people that work there aren't allowed to go to another farm. As the industry is striving really hard. It's not just this virus. Newcastle disease is the other virus they're trying to protect the industry about. But I think the interesting thing about what you said, too, is that they can try and make it into a positive marketing about the efforts we're going to keep our chickens safe, because they're already anticipating the public fear that will come if and when this virus is reported to be in North America, is to try and be prepared.
The thought of a building with 200,000 chickens in it and 12 buildings or 24 buildings lined up was mind-boggling.
Yeah.
One other question. Are you doing anything in Fairbanks with the arrival of the 747s over the winter from Asia in regard to this issue?
The human disease surveillance, then, is the other part of this, because the questions are, if I could just rephrase your question, how is this virus going to get to Alaska if it gets here, if H5N1 is to get here? One way is migratory birds. The other is it has become human to human, or somebody gets on an airplane not knowing they have the disease and they get here. And it goes to the question Senator Dyson asked already, too, about how do we know what it is. So if we had somebody getting off a plane in Fairbanks or Anchorage, coming from Vietnam, coming from a community in China where it's been reported that they have disease, and somebody's getting off with flu symptoms, the docs will be calling the epi staff, and we in all likelihood will be screening those samples. The every day now in our world, both from CDC and World Health Organization, there's updates that are coming in terms of what's the disease knowledge in other communities in the world. And as you said, with our airplane transmission in Alaska, our awareness of the possibility of human transport is high. Now, that also means our risk is high if it does become a human-to-human disease, because will we be able to intercept that person before they have spread it to a bunch of other people? If they come off a cargo plane and they're getting sick, there's a chance. If they come off a commercial plane coming from China and we have somebody sick, it's going to be way harder to contain this outbreak.
And you know, there's this burgeoning industry from Japan to Fairbanks nonstop for the winter northern lights and all that. And so if I'm on one of those flights and I get off and I have the sniffles or I have a cold, do you trap those people?
Well, I think at this point, as long as it isn't human to human reported, probably not. But the minute it starts being reported as community clusters in other community parts of the world, then the anxiety goes way up. Jay was a part of the team back in the SARS days that CDC was working with the quarantine service for the flights that were coming in and out of Anchorage. And I can remember talking to Jay after he had done shifts at the airport for the middle of the night planes coming in from China, and interviewing people before they were allowed to get off the plane. Those days could be coming back. The feds have established now a quarantine office in Anchorage. They now have it staffed with one person. The airport in Anchorage is updating its quarantine plans. We're working with them, and that's part of this planning about if and when this day comes, how do we start stopping planes before they disembark and doing interviews, and that'll probably be the way we'll do the screening, is before people get off the airplane.
Wow. Thank you.
Oh, I was just going to comment, and then a follow-up question to what you just said. I mean, I would hope, I mean, I understand the need to talk easily about chickens. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, if Foster Farms or Tyson's, I think, does a campaign saying, well, we're virus-free, I mean, that causes a lot of confusion in the marketplace. The example I'd use is mercury in fish. Another example is, we know what happens, being a former fishmonger, we know what happens when you say farmed salmon is bad. I mean, it just causes confusion in the public. They don't buy any salmon.
Yeah.
And that, but a follow-up question, I mean, if you get to the point where it's being transmitted human to human, I mean, I remember the debate that we had about the bill last year that gives you certain latitudes and freedoms to contain. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, it seems to me that it would be very, very difficult to preclude the kind of air traffic, for example. I mean, that just creates all kinds of problems for the economy. It makes things really, really difficult. But to have a good quarantine program, if somebody's getting off the plane with sniffles, as Senator Wilkins suggested, we're talking about a lot of money. It seems to me we're talking about teams greater than the TSA, number of TSA people in an airport, and yet the danger may be even higher with this. So, I mean, do you really think that we have much control over, you know, the movement of people?
Or you can hold that question about 10 minutes. Okay. That's exactly where we're going, because the question is mitigation, not control, I think, if you were to ask Jay and I. And the question is, how much can we mitigate without causing complete social and economic collapse?
Yeah, okay.
So here's the immediate work in front of us. We are presently trying to engage faith organizations, communities, businesses, and schools. The national government, in addition to the national response plan that was put out in November, we've updated our state plan. There are now checklists available for faith organizations, for communities, for government. Coming is for schools and for a whole lot of other, for individuals, et cetera, for people and organizations to use. This thing we call alternate care sites. Hospitals are going to be overwhelmed. So where are the lesser sick people going to be housed if their families can't take care of them? And who's going to staff those? How are we going to try and engage volunteers and protect them so that they're willing to volunteer and not be so afraid for their own health? Antiviral strategies. This question that Dr. Butler already introduced about, is it the public government's responsibility to have stockpiles? How much are we going to have? And then, assuming we do have drug, what are we going to use it for and for whom? The Swiss manufacturer of Tamiflu, it's made out of a natural product called star anise from China. They presently have 95% of the world's supply in their pipeline. They now have developed a synthetic technology that's coming online soon. They're now licensing to some other countries to manufacture this. But Tamiflu is going to be in short supply for the foreseeable future. Identification of essential services and workers. Businesses should assume that they will have 10 to 30% or more of their staff sick over, say, the peak 6 to 10 weeks of a pandemic rolling through their community. Which of their services do they, do they maintain? What are the essential ones? And who are the workers? For us in Alaska, the airline industries are probably much more important than they're going to be in Rhode Island, for example. So if we get a couple years down the road and we have enough antiviral medicines, we get to this question of protection that Dr. Butler hinted at and then evaded a few minutes ago, which is, if we're going to give drugs to prepare, to prevent illness, who are the workers and which are the critical industries? Healthcare workers, probably most people would agree. In our state, I'm guessing we'll say the airplane industry. What about the heating companies, the water utilities? Who else? The list quickly gets long, and if we have limited supply, who are we going to give meds to? If we just have enough to treat sick people, or have a limited amount, and we'll only have a amount of medicine to give a few days for prevention, then it gets even tougher.
Or and then politicians go on the list.
Well, and the question about policymakers. Most national lists I've seen put policymakers high on the list. Think about what would happen if this happened, though, during the legislative session. Would the legislature stay in session with the crowding and the airplane, and or would the legislature say, we need to quit for now and come back in 3 months? I mean, it would be an interesting policy call if this were to happen some winter in the not-too-distant future. And then we come to this new phrase that is new to me this winter called social distancing. And last year we talked about quarantine and isolation. Quarantine seems not to be a good word in most American language. It smacks too much of police powers and so on. So the language that's being used these days is social distancing, but it really goes to Senator Elton's question. because we won't have enough people, public safety people, to enforce mandatory quarantine. And we got to have goods and services coming in. Very few communities have more than a few days' worth of food. Very few families have more than a few days of food. So what do you do instead? One of the, there are many social distancing kinds of ideas floating around that we need to now try and get people to buy and communities buy into. For example, don't everybody go buy your groceries on Saturday between 3 and 6 in the afternoon, which is the peak grocery hours. Can we spread it out so people go late at night when there aren't big crowds to go buy your groceries? When the airplanes are coming in and out, how much do we have interface between companies and their consumers? What do churches do? Going to be all kinds of questions about where crowds gather. Lots of people said, well, we'll close schools. And schools say, well, if we have an illness rate of certain percentage, should we close our school? And what percentage is it? Well, the answer from the two of us is going to be, for at least a while here, it depends. Because if the kids don't go to school but go to the mall instead, and you just move where the crowding is, have you solved anything and now you don't even have supervision? If you have kids going home and their parents aren't home, is that a good social policy? In some schools, kids are getting two of their three meals a day at school. So if you close schools and they don't get nutrition, what does that do? So this becomes very complicated, and is why when we go back to the plan, train, and exercise, where we want to engage communities to be trying to be thinking about this, this will not be an easy thing to talk about in communities in the midst of this event. The more community leaders can have thought about this and have thought through how they're going to work through this, the better it's going to be, we think. So here are our planning assumptions as we work with communities. We think the antivirals are going to be in short supply. We don't think there will be a vaccine for at least 6 months. We think it will be a global problem. We think there will be widespread illness. We think the peak will be 6 to 12 months, that healthcare facilities will be overwhelmed. And the national level resources are probably going to run out or not be existent. Now, if this starts with wild birds in Alaska going to humans, we'll have so many federal resources here initially, it'll be just amazing. But if more likely it arrives on one of those airplanes and we're in the middle of the pack and most of the national resources have already gone to the big population states, we're going to be pretty much on our own. And so we think our planning needs to assume that we're going to really have to take care of ourselves in this state by and large. This gets now to the piece of paper you have about the preparedness concept plan. These are our immediate priorities in working with communities. Influenza annex, we've updated. The first edition was last March. The second edition is developed now in January. It's developed to integrate with the national plan. We have a lot of public information and education, as this conversation has shown today. We outreach to community and business leaders. My goal is to try and get it on people's agendas to be thinking about. The business and community leaders have lots of priorities. This one may not happen in the next few years, so how do you get it on your agenda if it doesn't happen right away? And then we need to do lots of support and partnership with communities for training and practicing and exercising and thinking about how they, what will work best in their communities. This is the best summary we've been able to come up with about what are the priorities for business and community leaders. Right now, this is one of those emergencies that we have time to plan for. Who are the essential workers? What are the essential functioners in businesses and communities? What do they think the potential impact is for Juneau with barges coming in? Is going to be different than some North Slope communities where everything comes by air. The barge industry may very well be an essential function for our state, and it probably wouldn't be for most states. And then emergency communications. During a pandemic, for example, for us as state employees, the state employment policies really discourage working from home. My message to the cabinet and to the Department of Administration is we need to develop plans that will encourage employees to work from home to the maximum extent possible if this happens, to keep people healthy, for let them take care of their families, and keep people on the workplace with if they can use computers. And then learn from each other. For example, Alyeska Pipeline has really good infectious control practices for how they handle seasonal influenza in the camps up and down the pipeline. we need to learn from how they do that in their business planning and what they tell their employees about if you're sick, do you come to work or not, and try and spread that to other businesses. And best Jay and I can tell, probably Alaska Pipeline probably has the best business practices that we all can learn from in the state. Legislative support, clearly updating HB 95. If we have a few years here, so the new virology lab can be up and operational, clearly then we will have capacity for screening many human samples. The other thing that's coming on the human screening in the near future, we hope, is a more simple screening for all of the viruses, including H5, that cause human disease on the same sample, so that instead it won't be an exception, but it'll be screening done on all samples. That's not here yet. These are the next steps, community leadership, that you could do that we'd like to ask your partnership with. When you go home, ask your community leaders, have they thought about this? What are they doing? You're showing your presence will clearly help convey the fact that this is important. And then we're going to get to this governor's funding initiative in a second, and then possible future legislation. I think in the next year or two, you're likely to see legislation proposed by us to deal with questions like, what happens to medical liability if we have to use alternate care sites? If docs and nurses now are working in a place that doesn't have complete hospital standards, are they protected from being sued for having had less tools available than would ordinarily exist in a hospital? If hospitals stretch and put more than two patients in a room, for example, use hallways or so on, are they protected from liability questions? If we bring volunteers to work in alternate care sites, what are they protected from liability concerns? So, and then licensing issues. Nurses that have retired and have let their license lapse. In a case like this, could we bring them back to work in a community quickly without having to reactivate their license and things like that? Those are issues over the next 12 months that we're going to be working on, and I fully expect when you come back next January that you will see some proposals from us around some of those questions. Around legislative issues. So this is the budget increment that's in the budget for improving our ability to do all of these tasks we've talked about. It's spread out across epidemiology, around surveillance, around the public health laboratory surveillance and ability to diagnose, nursing working with communities in their preparedness and how they would staff, how they plan for alternate care sites and so on. There's a capital project in the capital budget proposed. Just to tell a story or two about an immunization registry, one comes out of Katrina and one would be a hypothetical story in the future. Louisiana has had an electronic immunization registry in place for several years, and we knew on Monday after the earthquake or after the hurricane that people were distributing and moving quickly out of New Orleans area, and we started, and all the states started working with their software vendor to get access. We had access by Wednesday noon. We got the first call at 5 o'clock that afternoon from the Neighborhood Health Center in Anchorage of a family that had gotten off the airplane. They're coming to stay in Alaska with family friends. They had two boys. They wanted them in school the next day, and their immunization records died in the flood. We were able to dial in to their registry and had records for that family 10 minutes later. So rather than the family having to start immunizations all over again, they started school the next morning. And going forward in this kind of a story of pandemic flu, with the family dislocation and parents dying, kids are going to move, records are going to disappear, and if we rely on our present systems, which are all paper-based systems, we will deal with even more than what we deal with today when kids go to live with grandpa and grandma, or they go to live with aunt and uncle, records disappear, they don't exist. And so immunization registry, the other thing that we'll do is when we start giving flu vaccine, we can use it for adults, we can use it then to know when workers get transferred around communities to know who's had vaccines, who hasn't. And then disease surveillance, CDC is pushing all the states to improve our electronic disease surveillance and reporting that links up local hospitals to the state public health office and links to CDC. This will get us into that kind of a world where we can be linked both in-state among hospitals and then with all the other states in the country. And then the last item is the antiviral stockpile. So this gets at what Dr. Butler talked about. The national plan that the president announced assumes that the states will purchase and contribute to about 25% of the stockpile. And if the states will do that, the feds will then reimburse 25% of that purchase amount as another incentive. This would be our share of the stockpile. If this is appropriated, then we will add our purchase to the federal purchase. We'll be able to buy off the federal purchase price. As was said earlier, the current price in the public arena, we bought a tiny bit last summer for about $50 a treatment course. The national government is now reporting that they think they can buy it for $20. If that were to be true, this gets us a lot further down the road. Now, when will we have it? Don't know. The United States is late getting into the queue compared to many of the European countries, but the United States has enough leverage that it's our understanding it's moving rapidly up the queue. I don't know if that's right or wrong from a world perspective, but it just is. And the states that decide to invest will be able to get into that same place.
Before you leave that slide, Doctor, I mean, this is all preparing on the health side. I mean, what about is there money, additional money for waterfowl surveys by Department of Fish and Game, working with people along the Bering Sea, maybe they're watching the king eider population disappear and what's going on there? I mean, is there anything?
That's a really good question, because this year's governor's budget does not have anything for bird surveillance, because we all knew that there would be a lot of federal money for bird surveillance. But if H5N1 gets to Alaska this summer, I think we need to assume that the federal money for surveillance in Alaska is going to evaporate by next year, because it will all get invested then down south for protecting poultry industry. So by next year, if it gets here this summer, we need to be thinking about bird surveillance as to how and to how much does Fish and Game need to have it in their budget. To say I'm spending a lot of time in conversation with bird biologists and wildlife biologists in a way that I've never had before is to put it mildly. I've learned a lot about birds in the last 2 months. So in summary, it's likely that a pandemic will happen in the future. When? That's the question. We're better prepared, but we've got a lot of work to do. We believe that this is work that isn't wasted, even if we don't have a pandemic in the next few years, that it only improves our ability to deal with earthquakes, with tsunamis along the coast, because the community preparation of this is all transferable to other natural disasters. And you and the legislature really play a significant leadership role, and we hope we can work with you. And if you're looking for websites, Pandemic Flu is the national site. Pandemicflu.alaska.gov is ours. Two last things before I quit. This book, I want to quote, read a couple paragraphs from this book. If you're curious about the 1918 epidemic, this is the book that the President Bush read that really influenced him last fall when he asked for an emergency supplemental on the federal side. And the last is from the Wall Street Journal on January 12th. Is an article that has really influenced me, and it talks about language about just in time and just in case, and it really gets at the public policy questions that are in front of you. Industries all over America have gotten really good at just-in-time inventories over the last 30 years. All industries have stripped out warehousing, inventories come in one day, get used in manufacturing the next day. That works really well for business plans, but it works really badly for this kind of an emergency. And so the Wall Street Journal used a phrase that I'm using regularly now, just in case. And this is what the military does when they stockpile stuff for the possibility of some wartime event. But we don't tend to do much of that. And the question for the public policy question around this is, how much is a governmental responsibility to do just in case? And our argument is, at least on the stockpile question, we think on the antivirals is that that's a legitimate just-in-case expenditure. If we want to have it available, and if assuming that we're going to have to be on our own, that there isn't going to be national resources. And with that, I would like to read the last part of this book, if you can indulge me. And this is just the last two-thirds of one page. There was terror afoot in 1918. The randomness of death, its speed, and its tendency to kill off the healthiest brought that terror home. The media and public officials helped create that terror, not by exaggerating the disease, but by minimizing it in their attempts to reassure the public. One of the tragedies of 1918 is the public officials lied to the public and kept saying their communities were fine. Terror arises in the dark of the mind, an unknown beast tracking us in the jungle. All good horror movies build upon the fear of the unknown, the uncertain threat that we cannot see, do not know, and from which we can find no safe haven. In every horror movie, once the monster appears, terror condenses into the concrete and diminishes. Fear remains, but the edge of panic created by the unknown dissipates. In 1918, the lies of the official and of the press prevented the terror from becoming concrete. The public could trust nothing, and so they knew nothing. And this terror prevented one woman from caring for her sister, prevented volunteers from bringing food to families too ill to feed themselves and who then starved to death, prevented trained nurses from responding to the most urgent calls for their services. The fear, not the disease, threatened to break society apart. As Victor Vaughan, a man who did not overstate to make a point, warned, civilization could have disappeared within a few more weeks. So the final lesson of 1918, a simple one, yet the one most difficult to execute, is that those who occupy positions of authority must lessen the panic that can alienate the members of a society. A society that takes as its motto, every man for himself, is no longer a civilized society. Those in authority must retain the public's trust. The way to do that is to distort nothing, to put the best face on nothing, to try to manipulate no one. Lincoln said that first and best. A leader must make whatever horror exists concrete. Only then will people be able to break it apart. And I think that's our task with this, is to be honest, not to spread paranoia, but to do the best job we can to mitigate the effects, which could be profound on our society that year.
A couple things. One is that as you look at the budget, and there's obviously millions of dollars that are out there, and this possibility of a pandemic here in the future after the H5N1 situation goes away, much like the SARS possibility is part of the past. How do we make sure we don't build up a bureaucracy, then that becomes a dinosaur that is feeding on the finances, but there's no pandemic possibility out there?
I think that's a fairly important question, and it's going to be part of your vigilance and oversight that we don't just build this in and then use it for stuff that doesn't make sense. Now, the ordinary part of infectious disease is how we everyday train. So response to tuberculosis, response to STDs, response to norovirus, when they come, people get it off the cruise ships. That's how we keep staff trained. On the other hand, once we have done enough training, the communities are ready, and once we think there are enough alternate care sites identified, then I think it's a legitimate question. But I would advocate that with the turnover we have in the volunteer world and community leadership, we can't ever stop, because training we do will be good for a year or two and people will forget, they'll move on to other priorities. But I think especially with the stockpiling question, that's going to be a really important question about how much is appropriate, how much should we do. Do we drop out of the scene once things change and say Tamiflu becomes cheap and you can expect hospitals to have enough of it in the future? I think just in case will never be part of the ordinary hospital's drug availability, because they're under the same financial pressures to be lean and mean like all other businesses.
The other question I have is on a completely different subject and has to do more of a technical question. What advances have there been in irradiation to try and stop some of this viral transmission, either through ultraviolet irradiation or even X-ray irradiation? In that spectrum of irradiation, what are we seeing in advances in that aspect?
In the case of influenza, these are modalities that have not yet been identified as useful. Certainly irradiation may have a role in prevention of certain foodborne illnesses, particularly some of the bacterial infections, or for prevention of tuberculosis, but neither are currently known to have a role in prevention of spread of influenza.
Okay. And I looked at your plan here for, onto the next subject, your plan for the
state of Alaska in January 2006. As you look at it, I guess, what's going to be the involvement of some of the bush hospitals that are out there where they're already strapped for trained and licensed personnel? Is there anything unusual about that or anything that can be pointed to that's going to give them the ability to go and cope with some of these? Because obviously, as soon as somebody gets sick out there, as long as one of the physicians starts feeling uncomfortable, you know, it's a medevac to Anchorage or Fairbanks or wherever.
The rural provider issue in Alaska is a profound and important one. Two things about resources available. We have been receiving federal funds from an agency called Health Resource and Services Administration, HRSA, for bio-preparedness for the last 3 years. Up until this year, the priority has been to build in all hospitals the capacity to deal with chemical poisonings or terrorist events, radiation, etc. We're now refocusing a significant amount of that work for all hospitals in infectious disease preparedness. That's one. Two is this interagency effort to be headed by DMVA and DHSS will involve community and other business leaders, including rural and urban folks, both from the hospital industry and from community leaders. And then third, Nome, for example, is one community, and Kotzebue, but two communities up in the Northwest that have really been working with the training side and are moving into this alternate care site to say, how is in a rural community, how would that look? How would we find volunteers? How would we staff it? And Ketchikan is going to be the first community that's going to do an exercise. They're going to test for a couple of days, trying to see if they could keep 20 staffed beds operational, and how much work it would be to find trained volunteers. And that would be the first community that's actually going to try it. What we learned from Ketchikan, then what we've been doing is every time we do one of these in one community, then the best lessons we quickly spread, and it's been quite well received by community leaders in at least the hub communities in trying to move. Once we get out of hub communities into villages like Hooper Bay, McGrath, how are we going to do this in those communities where you have a single nurse practitioner, or if you're lucky, you got a nurse practitioner and a PA and their support staff and keep them healthy? They're going to have to be high on the priority list for trying to keep people healthy with antivirals, because there just is nobody to replace them.
And the last question I have is, what are the chances that there's going to be some type of an allergic reaction to some of these antivirals that are out there? What's the percentage on that one?
It's very low. The newer agents, particularly the oseltamivir, is very well tolerated. The older agents tended to cause a little more problem in terms of dizziness, sometimes bad dreams, but were also relatively safe. The inhaled drug can sometimes cause coughing and be a problem for people with underlying lung disease, which is unfortunate because sometimes those are the people we most want to get the drugs into. So it's fortunate that we have an oral form of that. But the experience to date with oseltamivir, which has been for several years now, looks very good. And it's one of the reasons why the federal plan focused on oseltamivir rather than the older agents was not only because it's thought to have much less risk of resistance, but also it appears to be clinically much better tolerated.
Thank you.
Doctors, it would be helpful to me if you already have it, maybe you could just distribute it to members of the committee, but it would be helpful to me to see some kind of a flow chart for decision making. I mean, who makes the decision, for example, on who gets the vaccine first? And not only within the state, but I just hate to bring up a tender subject, but I mean, you've got the Brownie issue with FEMA. You know, how does the state interact with the federal government if in fact we identify waterfowl in Alaska, for example? Who's in charge and how do they work together? That would be very helpful to me.
Senator Elton, some of that is done and some is yet to be done. For example, the question about if we have antivirals in short supply, who gets them, We have put on the, if you go to the website, you can see the first proposal that we basically have put out there in terms of the priority for who would get them if they're in short supply and we only got enough to treat sick people. I view that the, when I've asked the question to the commissioners, they've said, clearly the governor is going to want to weigh in on this. I think the decision making about how the legislature plays into this is partly why we think the plan needs to be well vetted, so to speak, and people have a chance to comment on it around, especially about, we're talking rationing decisions here, to be blunt, and who gets to decide about this is really an important question. It's not clear to me right now, other than the fact that there's a plan on the web right now that has a proposal, who would decide if this happened, let's say 6 months from now, and let's say we had a few more thousands of doses. That's what we would start with, but I think that other people, political leaders, would clearly want to weigh in the decision making. The issue about, especially when we get to prophylaxis, if we have enough medicine that we want to start protecting certain industries, how that gets done. I think that's a key function of this effort with DMVA and DHSS, is to get that question out there, to get it first talked about with a lot of people across state and local governments. But then clearly political leaders got to weigh into this too and got to look at this.
Well, I guess I'm especially concerned about the nexus in decision making between state officials who have some familiarity with what is happening in the state and federal people who, you know, have a tendency to come in and just say, well, this is the way we're going to do it.
Commissioner Campbell has made it really clear, as has the governor, instructions to us is we want to get ahead of this enough that it can be very clear that the state is in charge, and that if we ask when it comes to federal resources, that we're asking for federal resources and they're not forcing them. It's already gotten fuzzy with this summer's bird surveillance plan because the only people with money are the federal agencies right now. But it's been worked out so far between the federal and state agencies. But I think that's a really critical question, and at least as I've heard within the administration, it needs to be very clear that we're far enough ahead of this in our own planning that we're in charge.
Three questions. How is this different? We had the hysteria and the fear of the SARS virus 3 years ago. What's different?
Sure.
Why won't this just kind of go away like SARS did?
Yeah, a couple of things that are different between influenza viruses and the SARS coronavirus, which are really important in terms of that whole issue of containment and control of the epidemic. And most of it relates to the behavior of the virus in the infected person. In the case of SARS, the peak of viral shedding doesn't occur until the second week of illness, usually around day 10 to 12 of illness, whereas with influenza, infectiousness begins literally at the time of illness onset, if not even just before a person realizes that they're sick, and can peak in the first day or two. That window of opportunity with SARS, I think, was something we were really able to capitalize on, to recognize people who were at risk of having SARS, have them in isolation, prevent that degree of spread. SARS is also a different virus, and you know, even though I think it's tempting to say that the public health intervention completely contained it, I'm not sure that we know entirely that that's what happened. We know from past experience with influenza, we've never been able to contain it altogether. The pandemics have occurred in the past, and there's no reason to think they won't occur in the future as well.
Okay, thank you. Second question, the $1.23 million for the stockpile, doesn't product have a shelf life?
Yes, it has a shelf life of 5 years, and so the question is going to obviously be, so what happens next? We are beginning discussions right now with some of the drug wholesalers here in Alaska. There are a couple of companies. In an ideal world, if we did own the stockpile, from my view, it would be really nice if we had an agreement with them that they kept it, that we could draw, they would guarantee they had enough of it in state and we could draw down on it, but they would keep feeding it into the normal usage pattern and we wouldn't have to worry about it outdating. If we have to keep it And then when we get toward 4 or 5 years, then we've got a problem with replacement. Now, I think it's also true to say is FDA is presently looking to see whether, and there seem to be a lot of indications to say it has a longer shelf life than that. But at present, that's the FDA shelf life.
My last question, you mentioned water utilities. Should the major water utilities, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, Yasu, should this be something they should be having an internal plan for? Or is dimension of cure versus the disease?
Well, the question that I'm trying to get on business leaders and utility leaders' agendas is, what would happen for you to maintain, how would you maintain services if you had 10 to 30% of your staff out sick at any one time? How would you keep the water supply on in Anchorage, for example? And that's the part of the business plan for Alaska Pipeline. How do you keep the oil flowing if 30% of your sick people are sick for 2 or 3 months? Can you keep oil flowing in that, under that kind of a scenario?
So it's not so much the water itself, it's the infrastructure.
Yes,
there, right?
So yes.
Keep the water.
Yes.
There's another meeting here in a few minutes. I'm impressed with all the depth of what you're thinking about it. And one of the questions you raised is the liability for healthcare institutions and staff. Is there precedent for that?
No.
Is there something, if there's a national emergency declared, that's all the way out sin free, or?
I don't know that I know the answer for sure. I know it's being talked about a lot over the last 6 months. Almost all states have Good Samaritan laws that I think people would revert to, and most states like ours that have, in a governor's declared emergency, we've assumed that would protect people. I think a lot of people are enough concerned now to say we should make this more explicit under certain conditions, that we don't have people staying home because they have concern for their personal liability if they've got skills we could use.
So this legislative session is pretty interesting, at least, and it's liable to get very interesting here fairly soon. And what I would encourage you, if something you feel that we need to get done, let's get after it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think we're ready yet because we're trying to talk with colleagues across the country to get something that would be some kind of a model around this balancing point to make sure that we don't use it, that kind of authority, inappropriately, but also to use it to have it as a tool available. So whether we're going to be ready this session, I guess I'm a bit skeptical about. I'd be amazed if we're not ready by the time January comes around with a proposal for you all to think about.
Quick question that he asked with the malpractice liability, what are the chances of enacting some type of blanket federal torts coverage like we have in the 6-3?
I think that given that if we got into a national pandemic like this, that might be the fix nationally to say we need to just protect people all across the country. We can't have a state-by-state solution in this kind of a scenario, and that would make lots of national sense to me.
Anything else? I'm impressed with what you're doing. And thanks a lot for both doing it, raising my confidence level.
Well, we have a lot of work to do, but we got work we've already done. So thank you so much for your attention and for willing to hear us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.